From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Hope you're having an enjoyable Labor Day weekend. You still got another day to go. Emerging artists tonight for the first couple hours of bumper music. Later on tonight, astronomer Hugh Ross joins me as we discuss the improbable planet. It's a night of science for you tonight, by the way. Here's what's happening. Her mind moved far enough away from the eastern coast on Sunday to remove the heavy rain, but maintaining enough power to whip up dangerous waves and rip currents and keep beaches off limits to really some disappointed swimmers and surfers during the Labor Day weekend. As it churned hundreds of miles offshore in the Atlantic Ocean, the system is now picking up strength, and forecasters said it could regain hurricane force later as it travels up the coast. It was expected to stall over the water before weakening again to a tropical storm sometime Tuesday. Oklahoma City. Wow. Residents across the state there were rocked on Saturday morning after an earthquake struck central Oklahoma. It was 7 o'clock in the morning central time, a 5.6 magnitude earthquake. The experts at the USGS say the earthquake was felt in areas from Omaha to Dallas. Stan Deo, of course, is with us, expert on earthquakes. Stan, I still feel the big one is coming. What do you think?
I think you're right, George. Look, this is extraordinary. Over the last about 3 weeks, we've had four Richter 7-plus earthquakes across the planet. And certainly to have a Richter 5-plus or a 5.6 in Oklahoma City is significant to me because within 3 hours, there was a 5.6 up off your coast there near Gisborne. Not near Gisborne, but up near the Mendocino Fault going into Northern California. This is a concern because we're seeing big earthquakes on fault lines, plate tectonic fault lines, on the western side of the Pacific and in the Atlantic and in Europe and Italy and down near the South Pole. I tell you what, it's time for people to pay real close attention to this. If they're doing any exercises for people to get ready for earthquakes or emergencies, I think if they're doing it in your area, pay attention because something is happening.
Yeah, something indeed. I just feel it, Stan. You've got all the data, and I've got the gut, so something's going on.
Well, look, tell people to go look on show images page of standeo.com. You can find it under by the microphone. I put it up for you tonight. Later on, they can look at it, showing all the stuff at Yellowstone that registered this, all the seismometers. And, you know, there's 14 of these serious quakes in the last 3 weeks. I mean, just educate yourself. Get ready. Get prepared.
StanDeo.com, D-E-Y-O. Thank you, Stan. Mother Teresa, a Catholic nun who devoted her life to helping India's poor, has been declared a saint in canonization mass by Pope Francis in the Vatican. Pope Francis delivered the formula for the canonization of the Albanian-born nun known as the Saint of the Gutters before huge crowds of pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square in the Vatican City on Sunday morning. Applause broke out before he completed the formula of canonization, in which he declared the Blessed Teresa of Calcutta to be a saint. Authorities in central Minnesota have announced that the remains of a boy abducted 27 years ago have been found. The Stearns County Sheriff's Office said in a statement that Jacob Wetterling remains were identified. He was 11 years old when he was abducted in central Minnesota in 1989. Jacob was kidnapped by a masked man with a gun who approached him, his brother, and a friend on a rural Stearns County road. Police may have a suspect, by the way. They have somebody in custody that they're looking at for some other cases. He was also being looked at some time ago as a person of interest in the abduction of this case, so we shall see what happens there. Apple will attempt to reboot sales of the iPhone this week after an unprecedented recent decline that has left the tech giant grappling with falling revenue for the first time in over a decade. The company is seeking to entice you with a new version of the popular device that features a high-powered camera as its key selling point, amid fears that the smartphone market has reached saturation. The iPhone 7 is unlikely to come with the radical design changes that have defined the handset since Steve Jobs shook up the telecoms world with the first model almost a decade ago. Lauren Weinstein, expert on technology for us. Well, is this going to make it for Apple? What do you think, Lauren?
Well, they have kind of a low bar in this instance because as long as their batteries don't catch on fire,
Like Samsung.
Like the Samsung Galaxy Note 7 that's now undergoing a massive recall. That will be a plus mark for Apple for their new phone. As you said, there's not a lot of major items that are expected to be different in this. It'll still be very expensive. I'm hearing probably around $800.
Wow.
You know, that's for a phone that, you know, is considered obsolete in 2 years, maybe three, if you're an old timer that holds on to this stuff. Better camera system, as you said. Maybe some battery improvements, more colors, more memory. Actually, one of the aspects of it, and remember, this is mostly based on rumors and leaks because the real announcement isn't until Wednesday. There's a lot of concern that they may have dropped the traditional earphone jack from the phone.
And Steven Wozniak was really ticked off about that possibility.
Yeah, he wasn't happy about that at all. So there's all kinds of rumors flying about this that it's going to be a new kind of interface that, of course, would require new earphones or adapters. Perhaps the adapters will be included in some models. Maybe there'll be a wireless version in some models. So we don't really know. But it's interesting, you know, that earphone jack is a very, very old technology. It's just like the jacks we have in virtually every audio appliance, going back for decades, for many decades. And it's not terribly reliable. It's not very sophisticated, but it's a standard. And you can go out and you can get earphones that'll fit that anywhere, and they're very inexpensive. So people really get kind of ticked off when they hear about this. It'll be very interesting to see what happens with that. Apple's got a problem. The smartphone industry has reached a kind of saturation, and it's difficult to come up with the kinds of radical, exciting changes that Steve Jobs was able to march out on the stage and show. So now it's all incremental.
That's right.
And in a way, that means the industry has matured, and there's good aspects to that. But from a financial standpoint, it's getting tougher for them.
Well, most people are now saying, Lauren, that without major changes in high technology, why get rid of your phone and save some money?
Yeah, well, you know, and not only save money, save the planet a bit too. I mean, have you seen the photos of the piles of used phones that are piled up in you know, they ship
skyscrapers.
They ship them to other countries, and those things are full of all kinds of toxic chemicals and all kinds of really nasty stuff.
Good point.
So, you know, if you can hold on to a smartphone for a couple more years, you're doing yourself good, and you're doing everyone else some good too.
Lauren, enjoy the rest of your Labor Day weekend. A couple days ago, we reported that a rocket operated by the aerospace company SpaceX exploded on the launch pad at Cape Canaveral, where it was being test-fired ahead of a launch. They were going to launch a satellite for Facebook. Now conspiracy theorists are claiming that the rocket was attacked. The reusable rocket was destroyed after suffering a catastrophic explosion on a launch at Cape Canaveral, Florida on Thursday. Now, that huge blast, which caused no injuries, ripped through the rocket during a pre-launch check, sending plumes of thick black smoke into the air. But what you can see on camera is something very strange, maybe a drone, who knows? Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center was telling us that Friday. We've got lots to talk about with our science advisor and space historian Robert Zimmerman, and we'll get right into it next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm in St. Louis for my final week before heading back to Los Angeles. I hope you have had an enjoyable Labor Day weekend so far. You still got another day. Boy, our days are going to be all screwed up this week, though, that's for sure. Robert Zimmerman, award-winning space journalist and historian, has written a number of books and articles on science, engineering, and tonight on Coast to Coast, we will have a full science show. Dr. Hugh Ross joins us later on in the program. But, Robert, I can't think of a better guy to be with us on the Labor Day weekend.
Well, thank you, George. I appreciate that. It's a good time to be talking about science. Well, for me, it's always a good time to talk about science and space and the unknowns that surround us throughout the universe. So I'm glad to be here.
Have you done anything special yet?
For what, Labor Day?
Yeah.
Well, my wife and I did a really nice hike in the Chiricahua Mountain Monument on Saturday. We go hiking a lot. We live in Arizona where, you know, it has probably the most national parks in the country and some of the best. And that's one of the reasons we live out here. And so we went hiking and enjoyed the beautiful terrain and beautiful. Chiricahua Monument is one of the unknown gems in the national park system. Not many people go there, but it's probably as beautiful, if not more beautiful, than Bryce and Zion and a lot of ones that other people know. So, yes, that's what I did. And
that's
the other
great.
Today, I hung out, lobbed out, and do the same tomorrow. Why not?
I had the honor of being the honorary chairperson at the St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church in St. Louis, their 99th anniversary of their festival. And, you know, the mayor was there. We just had a great time. But a lot of coast-to-coast listeners, Robert, showed up.
Oh,
love
sure.
What we do. And I got to tell you this heartwarming story. A lady came up to Peter Vergaro, who is the MC of the event, and said, where's George? And he said, he's over there. And she was one of our listeners, and so was her husband. And she said, would he come up to our table? I want him to meet my husband, who just loves the show. So I came up to the table, and I met him. He's a blind individual. He's been listening to us since the beginning of time. He starts crying. He starts really getting broken up about meeting me. And it was very emotional for both of us. And he said, I need to tell you something. And I said, what? And he said, I can see with you when you're on the radio. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you paint pictures in my mind when you're on the radio, and I can see. And he said, thank you. And it was really something else. But you know what? When you hear stories like that, you know what? It's worth it.
Yeah, without question. And, you know, I have my webpage. I spent a lot of time today playing on the webpage, posting stuff, and I am always thrilled by the comments I get from people from all over the place that you know, it's refreshing because they give me ideas and help educate me on things, and I make me think of things I hadn't thought of before. And so I know where you're coming from. It's a great thing, and that's why it's worth doing this, talking to people about stuff.
So the SpaceX rocket blows up, but we had a chance very briefly to talk with you about that. But now some folks are saying, hey, did it get hit by something? Clearly, I see in a picture there is a little object floating around out there. But what do you think of that?
Well, all right. First of all, we all have to pull back and recognize the fact that the camera that was taking this imagery was 2.5 miles away. It is not a super high-definition camera. So what you're seeing is blurred. You don't know what it is. Could have been a bird.
Could have been a bird.
Secondly, the objects you see are flying past after the thing has exploded. That's two. Three,
yeah.
Though sabotage in these kind of events can always be a possibility, in this particular case, it doesn't look like it. In fact, my first thought when this happened was, my God, I can think of almost no accident like this. My first thought was that the explosion took place when they fired the rockets, did the actual static fire test, fired the first stage rockets and then turn them off. That's the stress rehearsal that they were doing. And so I thought, that never happens. You don't get a rocket blowing up when its engines turn on. So I thought, oh, man, with this sabotage, it actually occurred to me. But as soon as I found out, all right, there was an explosion prior to the firing of the rockets in the upper stage engine, then I knew, all right, it's not likely sabotage. In fact, it's almost impossible sabotage. It's more likely something was fundamentally wrong and something happened in the fueling process that they have to figure out what was wrong. And that's where I think we have to take it at this point. We love to speculate, but we really don't have good information from the outside here. Once again, the images we are looking at are not high definition. They are long-distance images, and they are fuzzy, and they're not going to give you the kind of data you need to really know what happened. It's really, 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 really unlikely that a drone hitting it could have caused that explosion. That's like, I think, nil. I always leave a little uncertainty there. I'm not, you know, I recognize the possibility. There's all possibilities. But in this case, I doubt it, and we're going to have to wait and see. The investigation is going to be really thorough. They're not going to hide things. If it was an outside source that caused this, trust me, they're going to want to tell us about that because liability issues, it will clear SpaceX of liability. You know, right now insurance costs go up and other people have problems, but if they can prove that it was an outside source, it'll be to their benefit. So they're not going to keep that a secret. I doubt seriously that's the case. Unfortunately, there is a problem here that's a serious problem. One of the things that we have to understand is this was a dress rehearsal. It was not a test. They do this at every launch, SpaceX. What they do, they really do this thoroughly. Before the first stage is shipped to the launch pad, they test it, do a static fire test with nothing but the first stage, all its engines in that McGregor, Texas test facility. Then they ship it to the launch pad, they assemble the whole thing with the payload, and they do a dress rehearsal a couple of days before launch of the countdown. It's the equivalent, actually, of a planned launch abort. They are planning to do the entire, they bring the rocket to the launch pad, they fuel it completely, including the payload, they get everything prepped, the whole thing's together, and they do the equivalent of an actual countdown right to the moment they fire the engines. And as soon as they fire the engines, they turn them off, equivalent to a launch abort. This is to make sure everything is functioning for the actual launch a couple of days hence. And it also practice for launch aborts because of something, a lot of times, right at T-minus zero, something happens and they've got to abort the launch. And so they do this routinely and have been doing this now for 7 years on every one of the launches. The Falcon 9 has launched something like 28 or 30 times, and they do that at every launch. And so they were doing a dress rehearsal. When you do a dress rehearsal, there's an expectation of success. It's not a test. When you're doing an engineering test, like them trying to land a first stage on a barge or on land, those are real engineering tests. There's actually there an expectation of failure. They say it. We don't expect it to work. We're hoping it'll work. Whatever happens will give us information to make it better the next time. That's an engineering test. This was a dress rehearsal. You have an expectation of success. And they didn't have success. Oh, boy, did they not have success. And the result of that is they have a serious problem. They've got to solve it. They've got to figure out, you don't have rockets on the launch pad.
Blow up like that. No. I mean, I used to remember years ago, I think, Vanguard launches in the beginning. You know, you'd have some mishaps or the rocket would not go straight. It would veer off and they'd blow it up or something. But you're right, Robert. They just don't blow up like that.
Not in recently. You know, in the last few, those kind of launches that go all over the place, they still happen. The Russians had a Proton launch just in 2014 during the summer. I have it's still on my website if you dig for it. It's an incredible video of this thing going up in less than 15 seconds after launch. It starts to go completely wild and it crashes. They don't blow it up. It literally turns around and goes right into the ground. Boom. And the Chinese had something like that happen in 96. It happens periodically in launch. But for a rocket to be sitting, being fueled, and to just go boom, is a rare event, and hasn't happened much in decades. And there's therefore a serious issue that SpaceX has got to solve. And it's going to impact a lot of things down the road. I mean, it impacts the companies. The satellite was an Israeli satellite. You mentioned Facebook. They were part of this, too. They had a satellite. But the main satellite, MO6, was an Israeli satellite. There was recently a merger deal announced in connection with that company. That deal could be off. They're suing SpaceX, the company that was involved. There's real ramifications there. And then SpaceX, they can't really launch anything till they figure this out.
If they had astronauts on top of that rocket, of course it was too small, but they would have been blown up, right?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure. This rocket would be the rocket they would be using.
Oh, my God. Okay.
This is the rocket they would use. This is why it's
they
really got to
find
problem.
Out what happened.
This is the rocket they would be using, exactly the rocket you see. They have a Dragon capsule. This is the same rocket they used to launch the cargo Dragon capsule. There's really no significant difference. There's detailed differences that are really important. When the Dragon capsule has people on it, one of the things they have to develop for the Dragon capsule is the launch abort system, so that when something goes wrong,
like this,
the capsule can be separated and get away.
Yeah.
Well, the problem you have here is that this explosion was real fast. Now, if you watch the videotape, I've got it on Behind the Black. People can go look at it again. If you watch the videotape, the second stage explodes. The payload sits on top of the rocket for at least 10 seconds, 15 seconds, maybe 20 seconds, maybe even a little longer than that. Eventually, Because the second stage is gone. It
falls apart.
It's only being held up by the gantry, essentially. It falls over, crashes, and then blows up. Well, so therefore you had a window there where it's conceivable the launch abort system could have separated the capsule away and gotten the astronauts out. The margin here.
Hold on, Robert. We're going to hit the break. We're going to come back in just a moment. And welcome back. We'll take phone calls with Robert Zimmerman next hour. Robert, we were talking about the possibility of astronauts being aboard a rocket like that, and you were saying it indeed is the one that would push us up there.
Yeah. The margin of error here is very small. We've never had a rocket explode like that in that circumstance. It's rare. And so the importance of finding out what went wrong here is really important. I mean, it's going to impact SpaceX's manned Dragon capsule. It's going to impact their attempt to launch a Falcon Heavy in November. That's going to probably be delayed. Falcon Heavy would be the most powerful rocket built since the Saturn V, and it would cost about a tenth the amount. It's going to impact their cargo missions. They were trying to also ramp up their commercial launches this year to try to really get clear up their manifest schedule of contracts so that they could start signing more customers. That's going to be a problem for them now. It really has ramifications all the way down the line. It's going to maybe help some of their competitors. It's competition. It's a good thing. Boeing, for example, has its Starliner capsule, which is one of the two companies that NASA contracted for this. And so both of them are trying to develop their capsule to try to get humans to ISS by 2017 or 18. But Starliner was looking like it would be the second to launch. Now maybe not. It might be the first. It's a good thing we have redundancy there. This means if one goes down, the other is still there. It's definitely a big deal. It's an unusual accident, so therefore it's got to be looked at really close. What the cause is, though, to speculate now, I think it's too early. We don't have access to the really close information, and we're just going to have to wait it out to see.
All right, so let's talk about some other incredible things that are going on in space, Robert, and that, of course, is these planetary searches and what's happening there. Wow, it's exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, I've been doing, it's one of the things I've been doing recently on Behind the Black, which is really cool, is I've been really delving deeply into the raw images that come down from both Opportunity and from Curiosity to try to get a real sense of where they are on their journeys and what's coming up next. And that it's a perspective that doesn't even get covered by NASA very well to get an idea. For example, Curiosity has been moving through this region of buttes. It kind of looks like the Southwest. They're short buttes. They're only about 100 feet high. But it looks like it's in Monument Valley at first glance. And then you take close looks at the images they're getting of these really strange rocks, and you realize this is not Monument Valley. This is an alien planet with one-third gravity on Earth, which means you can have rocks that appear to be floating in space almost, because the formations can be, you know, rocks can be on a really steep slope and not fall down because the gravity is much less. And so that's one thing. And what's going to happen next, I can get a sense of its journey up Mount Sharp. I've been trying to map its future path. And then Opportunity, about 2 months ago, they announced that what happened is Opportunity has been exploring the rim of Endeavour Crater. This is a 14-mile-wide crater, large crater. It took them almost, 10 years to get there from their original landing site. And so they've been exploring the outside rim. And then about a year ago, they reached what they called Marathon Valley, which is a cut that cuts through the rim. And so they started to explore in this cut. And there was always the opportunity to drive through the cut into the crater. And, 2 months ago, they announced that they were wrapping up exploration of Marathon Valley, and they were going to start heading out to explore the outside of the rim again. And so, okay, that's what everyone thought. Well, I've been looking at the close-up images, and I posted a bunch on Behind the Black to point out that they, instead of leaving the Marathon Valley, they went back into it again. And then they started to poke around even farther in than they had been before. And so I emailed some of the project scientists, one of the project scientists there I've talked to in the past, and asked him, are you guys dithering? Are you really going to leave Marathon Valley? Are you going to go into the crater? And he emailed me back and said, and I posted this on Behind the Black, he said, no, well, we have been dithering. We're like kids in a toy shop. There's so many interesting things there we couldn't quite leave. And then we decided, instead of going to the outside of the rim, we're going to head south through a gap in the valley and start exploring the interior of the rim. This would not be in the crater, and this would not be on the outside edge of the rim. This would be exploring the very rough, mountainous, rocky, difficult terrain inside the rim. And I mapped out a few of the potential routes they could go, and this is going to be really interesting, and it's going to be interesting terrain, almost as interesting as what Curiosity has seen is at Mount Sharp. And those are just the two rovers. I mean, we've got a new rover coming in 2018. We've got a lander coming in a new rover.
And how advanced are they from the rovers that are on Mars, for example, right now?
Well, the 2020 rover is basically a dupe of Curiosity. They might have upgraded a few minor things, but they made a decision that we want to get another rover there. What's the best way to do it? Well, rather than rebuild or redesign something, let's just use what works. And so they're basically rebuilding Curiosity, which makes a lot of sense, actually, because it's proven to be extremely robust. It's been flying, it's been driving for 4 years. It looks like there's no reason why it cannot go for 10, 20 more years. Opportunity was only supposed to be last for 3 months, and we're now into the dozens, 12th year of operation. So these are very robust objects. They one of the missions, the next 2 weeks are going to be really exciting, George, because on the 8th, NASA is going to be launching OSIRIS-REx, which is an asteroid sample return mission. And the asteroid it's going to, Bennu, is a known potentially dangerous asteroid. Sometime in the next 200 years, it has a potential of hitting the Earth. And so studying it makes a lot of sense. And they're going to bring samples back. And then on the 15th, sometime around the 15th, China is going to put up its next space station, and they're going to follow that up with a 30-day mission. So that should be really, really interesting. So there's lots of things going on in the next few weeks. You've got Juno right now.
Oh, great pictures from Jupiter.
I posted on Behind the Black their first pictures of the the pole from the north and south poles, where you see, you know, you look at Jupiter, the traditional view of Jupiter.
And I thought Jupiter was all gas.
It is. It's a gas giant. But, you know, it's a very big thing. It's a very big thing. If you go to Behind the Black and look at the pictures of the storms, these storms, you could probably fit an Earth or two in them. And this is just a small part of the...
Well, Robert, let me ask you this. So if it's a gas giant, why aren't... I mean, and it looks, it's a sphere,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Why aren't the gases escaping off into, you know, space, and this planet would look not round, but just, you know, all messy?
It's gravity. So, first of all, look, think of the Earth. We've got an atmosphere. Our atmosphere does not escape. Gravity holds it in place. And if you look at pictures from ISS looking at the horizon above the atmosphere matches the curve of the planet because the gravity holds it in place. Well, Jupiter's gigantic. It has a much bigger gravitational field. That's why we don't know where the solid center of Jupiter is and where it transitions into gas or liquid. We don't know this. This is one of the things Juno is going to try to find out. Most of the planet that we can see, I mean, that we all of it we can see, but going down deep into it, it's gas. And it's gas getting denser and denser and denser in very complex patterns of weather. The traditional view of Jupiter, we look at the equator, we see bands, horizontal bands of storms, like the jet streams on Earth going, you know, because of the rotation of the planet. But now we're getting views of the poles from Juno, and the poles are chaotic and very different, and they are not like anything we've seen anywhere before. And so we're getting a real taste of the alienness of the weather patterns on a gas giant like Jupiter. And as I've said on your show many a time, Every time we look at another object in the solar system closely, we discover it is completely different than every other object we've looked in the solar system closely. And so Jupiter's poles are actually very different than the poles of Saturn. The storm processes there don't look the same. And so it's a mystery, and we have to study it.
Who comes up with these novel ideas at NASA to create these probes that go to different planetary systems?
What happens is NASA, it's kind of a give and take between the science community and NASA. The science community in both astronomy and planetary research, every decade or so, they put together what they call a decadal survey. They basically talk to each other and they publish their recommendations for the next decade. They hand that to NASA, and then NASA uses that as a guide to propose a variety of missions along the lines of what the scientists proposed. And then the scientists compete for the projects. The ones who suggested it don't have a guarantee they're going to be the ones launching it. In fact, there's no guarantee at all. They have to compete against each other proposing the best mission. And so that is what happens. And so that's the essential process. So the scientific community, they know what the questions are. They know what research they want to do. They know where they haven't gone or where they need to go better. And so they make proposals. And then NASA uses that as a guide. That's the general process. When it comes to the probe, the rover that's going to be flying in 2020, their politics got involved. NASA's planetary program got cut very badly in the early part of this decade. A lot of projects they were going to launch were not launched, were canceled. And what the Obama administration, as it was canceling many things, they basically said to NASA, well, you got to think of some way to do something cheaply. And so they came up with the idea of just flying another Curiosity. It's a less costly way to do it, and they can do it quickly. And so that's where they came up with, as a way to compensate for the fact that they were canceling a lot of other missions.
This morning in Asia, North Korea launched three more missiles. Robert, where are they getting this incredible technology to be?
Well, there are stories I've seen where it suggests China has been sending them a lot of information. Iran has been doing deals with them for several years. Ronald Reagan called the Axis of Evil. North Korea, Iran, they kind of work together in some of this. So that's where a lot of that technology is coming from. They did a launch from a submarine recently, and it's thought that that submarine technology came from China. That's very scary, because if you've got nuclear capability and you've got a rocket you can launch from a submarine, it's impossible to stop it, because you don't know where the rocket will launch.
Park it right off your coast.
Yeah, it's very, very scary, because this is a crazy country, and leadership is power hungry and crazy, and there's no guarantee. There's no, you cannot account for madness.
You really can't. I mean, God forbid you could wake up one morning and find out three cities have been taken.
Yeah, and this is a real concern. North Korea, it's very dangerous. And Iran is a similar thing. They've got a space program. They announced they're going to launch three satellites next year, and they claim these are all peaceful space program, but the reason when you can launch a satellite into orbit, you've basically built it. It's a countercontinental missile, which is a ballistic missile, which an ICBM that can put a payload anywhere on the Earth. And if you then develop nuclear technology, you have the capability of putting a bomb anywhere on the Earth. And Iran is a country that has called for the destruction of some its neighbor Israel, as well as destruction of the United States. They routinely call death the United States. So I take them as a word. I always think back to Hitler. He wrote Mein Kampf. He told us exactly what he wanted to do and what he was going to do. No one believed him. He went ahead and did it. Mm-hmm. Well, these guys, North Korea and Iran, they say what they're going to do. I take them at his word. We shouldn't be nonchalant about that.
It's a dangerous place.
The world is a dangerous place. The world is always a dangerous place, though. That's the one thing that must be understood, that this is not any different than any other time in history. If you believe in freedom and the rights of individuals, you got to defend that. And there's always people that want to take those rights away, and you just have to defend it. That's all there is to it.
What is our next step in sending men to some object?
Well, NASA, there is a a proposal by the Obama administration to send astronauts to an asteroid. But this is a boondoggle, and I don't think it's ever going to fly. Obama proposed this back in 2010, and he has never been able to get Congress, even a Democratic Congress, to fund it. They've never funded it. What NASA's been doing is it's been diverting money from other programs. That's one of the reasons the planetary program got cut, by the way, to fund it up to now. But that's funding an unmanned planetary.
Why would we want to put a man on an asteroid?
Well, all right.
Unless we're Bruce Willis.
I'm not against going sending humans to an asteroid. You could mine the asteroids. There's a potential there of knowledge and profit. There's no question of that. But the actual proposal that NASA is that's being pushed by the Obama administration to go to an asteroid with humans is a pointless effort. It's going to cost too much money, and it's not really a smart move, not at this stage. Going to an asteroid, look, I just talked about Osiris Rex going to a sample return at Bennu. They're going to an asteroid, manned or even unmanned, is worthwhile doing at some point. But you have to do it smartly, and that particular manned mission, one of the reasons they can't get funding for it is because when Congress looks at it, they say, well, this doesn't make any sense.
What could be on it? I mean, an asteroid of diamonds, gold?
Well, okay. Depends on the asteroid. Some asteroids you go for scientific research. Some asteroids you go because they potentially could hit us, and you want to learn as much about them so you can prevent them from hitting us. Some asteroids, nickel iron asteroids in particular, have a lot of nickel iron. In fact, one of those asteroids, not even a very large one, because it's really pretty pure, would have more nickel iron than we've mined in the entire history of the United States of the world. So there is minerals there that can be accessed and used. But so there's a lot of reasons to go to an asteroid. You don't just dismiss it, but you go smart. You don't go for political reasons, for aggrandizement of a politician. You go because you'll learn you something, or you'll gain profit from it.
What has created the propulsion of the asteroid, the force?
Well, all right, asteroids orbit the sun. And they have an orbit just like the Earth does.
Is it all gravity again?
It's all gravity. And so they're in their own orbits, and there's a large number of them in all different places in there. There's some that they call near-Earth objects, which orbit in orbits similar to the Earth. One, in fact, is a semi-satellite of the Earth, like the Moon, except it doesn't orbit the Earth around and around and around like the Moon does. It kind of orbits the Sun in the same orbit as the Earth and kind of does a dance around the Earth, sometimes coming closer, sometimes going farther away. And then you got the asteroid belts, you got lots there. And then you got a lot of other asteroid families that orbit in different kinds of ways. Some are inside the orbit of the Earth, some are outside, some eccentric orbits, you don't know where they're going to go. And so, all right, so you got lots, that's all gravity, and it's all related to the initial formation of the solar system. That placed them here, and this is something we don't completely understand, and we don't have a complete census of all the asteroids that are out there. And so the more study you have to do of asteroids, the more you can learn not only about the formation of the solar system, but the more chance you will have identified those that could go bang, hit the Earth, and do a lot of harm and do something about it.
Are they from a planet that didn't form together or a planet that blew up?
Well, okay, in the case of the asteroid belt, there are, in fact, Dawn visited Vesta, 2 years ago before it went to Cirrus. And Vesta is considered to be a failed planet. Did it blow up? That implies an explosion like SpaceX. More likely, in the formation process, you've got a lot of big objects hitting each other, and they eventually accrete together to form a larger object like the Earth or a gas giant like Jupiter. But sometimes two big objects hit and they break each other up into lots of little pieces. And Vesta is thought to be one that was larger at one point and it got big impact and broke it up and it never formed the planet. So a lot of these asteroids, yes, they were broken up from impact. Some of them were just in the initial formation of the solar system, and they never merged with anything. They're just small objects out there on their own. Those are interesting because they'll tell you something about the early solar system.
Robert, we're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Final hour to go with you, and let's take some phone calls. This is an all-space night tonight on Coast to Coast AM. So if you're into space and science, you're going to love it.